Honorable Supreme Court of the State of New Mexico.
Good afternoon. You may be seated. Thank you. Good afternoon. We're here on the matter S1SC-40574, inquiry concerning a judge. Petitioner may enter her appearance. You have 8 minutes in opening.
Marcus Blaze with the Judicial Standards Commission. Justices, Chief Justice, may it please the court. The commission is asking this court to adopt its findings and recommendation to permanently remove respondent from judicial office. I'm going to focus my arguments on the arguments posed by the respondent in his response, that is both that the respondent should have more due process and also his legal interpretation. I'll start with the due process argument. The respondent gets due process throughout the proceedings. That includes a notice of investigation that's sent. The respondent responded to that notice of investigation. He then sat down with the commission in February of 2024 for an ICC, an informal confidential conference, to talk with the commission about what he had done. There were then formal charges filed. That notice of formal proceeding went out in the summer of 2024. He was able to respond to that. A hearing on the merits took place April of 2025. He was represented by counsel the whole time. Respondent says that, or makes the argument that there should have been a panel of three judges in this particular case. We are a single-tiered system here in New Mexico for judicial discipline. That is the same as 32 other states. There are 33 total states that have a single tier where the Judicial Standards Commission, the Judicial Discipline Commission, it holds both an investigatory and an adjudicatory role. That's how it's set up in our Constitution as well. It says the commission may, after investigation it deems necessary, order a hearing to be held before it.
I think the argument, if I'm reading it right, is the judicial standards is the accuser. They investigate, they hear, they adjudicate, and make a decision. And that by wearing all those hats, it's inherently a denial of due process, because you cannot, doing all of these functions under one hat is just not fair. Is that the understanding of, your understanding of the argument?
Chief Justice, Justice Vigil, that is my understanding of the respondent's argument.
And so what's your response to that? That it's fair?
Chief Justice, Justice Vigil, that is correct. It is fair. And it's fair not because I say it's fair. It's fair because the United States Supreme Court said so in the Withrow case. The Withrow case, I'll just quote from that case, the contention that the combination of investigative and adjudicatory functions necessarily creates an unconstitutional risk of bias in administrative adjudication has a much more difficult burden of persuasion to carry. It must overcome a presumption of honesty and integrity in those serving as adjudicators.
If you're judging your own mother, you may be doing it with integrity, but does it even look fair?
Chief Justice, Justice Vigil, I understand the argument. According to the Constitution and according to U.S. Supreme Court precedent, it is fair. The Constitution, again, says that the commission may, after investigation it deems necessary, order a hearing to be held before it. Similar to Rule 21207, where judges have the obligation to hear cases before it, the commission also looks at the Constitution and determines that they should not shirk their duty in hearing cases. According to the Constitution, they have hearings before them, and they don't want to shirk their duties, and that's why they hear these cases. That's set up in the Constitution. It's set up with the United States Supreme Court precedent. Let's talk about what New Mexico has said before in its 2008 Rodella case. In that case, The judge claimed the commission acted improperly by failing to refer the investigation and fact-finding in this matter to special masters in order to ensure objectivity. Same argument that we have here. In paragraph 6, this Supreme Court recognized the smaller function, the smaller role that the commission played. It said specifically, the commission has no power to remove or sanction judges, but only makes recommendations to this court, which has final decision-making authority. In paragraph 7, this court says this court's power to review the commission's actions ensure the independence of the commission in fulfilling its role in overseeing judicial conduct. Finally, in paragraph 8, the decision whether to appoint special masters is left to the discretion of the commission, and we have been presented with no evidence of an abuse of that discretion. So the Withrow case from the United States Supreme Court came out in 1975. Since that decision, in the last 50 years, no state Supreme Court has found a due process violation by a single-tiered system. That includes the most recent case in 2022 and the state of Michigan. That's the Judge Morrow case. The state Supreme Court said, Withrow still strongly supports the constitutionality of our judicial discipline scheme. Also in Kentucky, back in 2012, the Kentucky Supreme Court said, and the reason I'm reading this, I understand it's not mandatory authority, but the reason I'm reading this is because the commission is asking this court to find this same thing. Because both federal law and Kentucky law have found that the combination of investigative and adjudicatory function in administrative bodies is not inherently flawed, and Judge Allred offers no persuasive evidence to overcome this presumption, we find no violation of constitutional due process rights. That's what the commission is asking this court to find today as well. Also, we're talking about a presumption or the appearance that there could be some bias. In this particular, let's look at this particular case. In this particular case, the notice of investigation that went out in October of 2023 had 17 different counts that respondent was accused of, 17 different counts. That was October 2023. You'll remember there was an ICC, an informal confidential conference, that took place in February of 2024. The notice of formal proceedings that came out the summer of 2024, only 5 counts. He had successfully explained away 12 of those counts. So again, that's just evidence that there is no bias in this particular case. When the hearing on the merits commenced in April of 2025, the respondent was facing 16 different charges. What's before this court? 14 different charges. 2 charges weren't proven by clear and convincing evidence. So again, that just proves that there is no bias in the process, especially in this particular court. The commission regularly receiving ex parte secret communication. What that is just confidential information. It's confidential because of policy, and it's confidential because of what's contained in the Constitution.
Time is up. Thank you, Counsel. All right, we'll hear from respondent. After your appearance, you have 20 minutes.
Good afternoon, members of the court. Jack Brandt, and I'm here representing the respondent, the Honorable Brandt Detsoy, who's here with me at council table today. Thank you. May it please the court, on behalf of Judge Detsoy, we respectfully request the court to deny the petition for discipline for 2 reasons. First, because the commission's failure to appoint masters to decide the merits of the charges denied Judge Detsoy fundamental fairness. And second, because the commission's basing of all of the charges upon alleged legal errors by Judge Detsoy in presiding over his court constitutes a fundamental flaw in these proceedings, because allegedly committing judicial error should not form the basis of a charge of willful misconduct in office. Regarding the failure to appoint masters, imagine if in a criminal matter, the police officer who investigated the charges and who filed the criminal complaint then sat as the jury to decide the charges on the merits. That would be intolerable.
But isn't that what our Constitution provides? Isn't that what our Constitution provides?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it requires that the same people decide it. It gives the option. Our Constitution gives the option.
It's an option.
Well, we're here to argue to this court that you should take a look at this situation with fresh eyes. I would suggest or argue to the court that you have the ability to interpret the Constitution and to decide that either, that in order to promote fundamental fairness and due process of law, either the commission should appoint masters or it should divide itself up into an investigative function, an investigative panel, and an adjudicative panel in, under the model of the ABA model rules of judicial discipline, which we provided in our briefing. Effectively, what happens in the New Mexico Judicial Standards Commission proceeding when the commission decides to appoint masters to hear matters on the merits, the same people who have investigated the charges and who have decided that formal charges should be brought are the same people who decide whether the charges that they themselves decided to bring are well-founded charges. That situation is fundamentally at odds with our system of jurisprudence. That situation...
But I think there's a hole there, and Mr. Blaise, I think, touched on it, or actually said it, from the Rodella case. The commission is not adjudicating. The commission is not making the decision. The commission is making a recommendation. The final decision maker is the Supreme Court. So I think there's a little bit of a difference there between your hypothetical and what's going on in these cases.
Well, Your Honor,
what am I missing?
I would respond in two ways. First of all, in my reading of the Rodella case, this issue of due process was not the main issue that was brought up. That was not the main focus of the attack on the way the Judicial Standards Commission conducts itself. It seems to me like in that case, it was more of a separation of powers argument. There was some argument that the Judicial Standards Commission itself was a political body and that that was a separation of powers issue with the judiciary. And the second thing I would argue is that it is by its nature and I think by its title, it's an adjudicative function. The charges are investigated, formal charges, if they decide to bring formal charges, they're brought. And then there's an adjudication by a hearing panel. Now, I understand that then this court gets to review that, but that's a limited review. You're not finding facts. You're not determining credibility of witnesses and so on. So I think that's the way I would respond to that, you know, potential hole in the argument. If that's not an adjudicative function, then I don't know why we do it at all. They could just put the facts together and bring it up to this court, but that's not what you're asked to do. You're asked to look at their findings of fact and conclusions of law and decide whether those establish a basis for judicial discipline. So,
looking at what we are able to do, which is review the factual findings for at least substantial evidence, is there any place that you would point us to where you don't believe there's substantial evidence to support the board's finding?
No, Your Honor, not specifically, but I would go back to the point that those factual findings were made by an adjudicative body that has the appearance, at least, of having prejudged the issue. So I think that there's a flaw if you're going to rely on that adjudicative body to decide facts, that should be an adjudicative body that has not been involved in the investigation and the charging function. So Let me just read, if I could, from the ABA model rules, because I think this is informative. The ABA model rules seek to separate the investigative and adjudicative functions of the commission members. And this is the important point. No matter how fair individual members can be, the system cannot convey the appearance of fairness when members have full access to investigative materials, formulate their decisions to file charges in reliance on the investigative files, and then make adjudicative decisions based upon the evidence presented in formal proceedings. This process is in conflict with fundamental division of investigative and adjudicative responsibilities that is a hallmark of our judicial system. And I think that's the point here. I think there are two options, and this court could basically, I believe, in interpreting our constitutional provision, enter an order which requires that the commission either appoint masters or divide itself into investigative and adjudicative panels. And we argued that they could do that here, and they turned us down. We asked for the appointment of masters in order to solve these issues, pointed out all of these problems with the basic fairness and the appearance of impropriety, and they turned us down without even explaining their reasoning or addressing any of it.
Can I ask you to address the second issue, which is counts 9 and then 12 through 16? There's more counts, but those ones were the ones that were emphasized by the parties. And I'm just wondering your response to the recommendation of removal and on just to address those counts.
Your Honor, those counts are all based upon a determination by the Judicial Standards Commission that Judge Detsoy committed legal error in his rulings in those cases. And the second point of our request that the petition be denied is based upon the argument that the Judicial Standards Commission exceeds its authority and it exceeds its capacity in looking at what judges do in cases and basing formal charges on the allegation that the judge ruled incorrectly in those cases.
So I have a problem with that kind of generalized statement. And it's very generalized in your briefing as well. Because if you have a judge who routinely suppresses evidence because it's from APD, just to take a completely unrelated example, erroneously suppresses over and over again because they've got, you know, some kind of beef against APD or what, for whatever reason, but they make the same error despite being counseled and coached to not do that. I think that does become a standards problem because whack-a-mole appeal isn't going to address a judge who refuses to follow the law. And refusal to follow the law is a problem. It's not a mistake.
Right.
And some of what's alleged here, to my mind, approaches that here. Yet you're saying, oh, standards can never weigh in if it's just legal error. And those two things don't seem to coexist well, to my mind.
Well, a couple of things, and Justice Zamora asked specifically about 9 and 12 through 16, but I would point out that there are a whole bunch of other charges that don't involve that kind of a situation. That's number one. Number two, Judge Detsoy testified that he had reasons why he believed that it was appropriate to do that, and his reasons are that, especially in Indian country, where jurisdictional issues are difficult, in his view, a complaint should, on its face, provide a basis for subject matter jurisdiction, and that these complaints didn't do that. And his concern was, rightly or wrongly, that lacking subject matter jurisdiction or lacking an affirmative basis for him to conclude from the complaint that he had subject matter jurisdiction. He had questions whether he had the authority to hold a hearing at all. So it's not a situation where he was simply arbitrarily dismissing cases, as to use your example, that were brought by the police department or whatever.
So his position,
this is a subject matter jurisdiction issue. It's a complicated issue, and he was trying to make the best decisions he could based upon his understanding of the law.
So just so I'm clear, some of the charging documents in magistrate court aren't even complaints. They're citations. They're way more informal. But the position of your client is that in each of those charging documents, regardless of what it was, should have alleged subject matter jurisdiction within the four corners of the paper.
Should have either indicated non-Indian, or it should have indicated the stop was on state land. And when they didn't do that, he was concerned about exercising power that he didn't have. And again, you know, rightly or wrongly, that's not willful misconduct in office. That's a judge trying to apply the law, to trying to figure out what's the best decision to hold in a case. It's a difficult analysis.
Do you concede that happened without... So normally if a judge would bring up an issue sua sponte, they would hopefully set a hearing, give the parties notice of what the issue is, allow them to brief the issue and present evidence, or if they chose, on the issue. Did your client do that in any of these cases?
He did that in some cases. He tried various ways to do this. He tried to subpoena the police officers to come to court. He issued show cause orders and asked people to ask the parties to come to court and brief it up. People wouldn't show up. It got to be a situation where, in his view, there was not, that wasn't a productive use of his time to do that in those cases. And I would also say again, I think it's a serious question of law whether, if a court believes that it may not have subject matter jurisdiction, it has the authority to hold a hearing. It seems like, I don't know how that works, but if a court lacks subject, my understanding of the law is if a court lacks subject matter jurisdiction, that's the end of the inquiry. You cannot proceed.
Mr. Brown, based on the evidence in the findings, it appears there were about probably 40 cases that were appealed to the district court that I was able to identify out of 100 cases that were dismissed. Were any of the 100 dismissals after a decision on the appealed cases had been made?
My understanding of the record and the facts that are in the record that's before you is that there is no evidence that in any of those appeals, there was a decision made that there was, in fact, subject matter jurisdiction over these cases.
The court found no jurisdiction in every case. The court found no jurisdiction in every case.
No, the court didn't make a ruling on jurisdiction in every case. No, the court decided that because there wasn't a hearing held, they returned them to the magistrate.
They sent them back?
Yes.
So was a hearing held then?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't think that the record before you reflects that one way or the other.
Okay.
I mean, I think there's an open question here whether there was, in fact, subject matter jurisdiction in these cases.
But that's why a hearing was so critical, right? I mean, where everyone's involved, the issues are in front of the court, everyone has a point of...
Judges regularly have hearings on subject matter jurisdiction, even when they question whether there's subject matter jurisdiction.
You may be right about that.
I know I'm right because I did it.
Okay.
And so did he. You know, it's not a, I decide I don't have subject matter jurisdiction and parties be damned. It's a,
get the parties in, have a conversation, and then decide if you have subject matter jurisdiction or not. And that happens in issues related to sovereign immunity all of the time. So it's not specific that this is, because this is Indian country, or, you know, it's not specific to that. You give the parties an opportunity to explain to you why, and you give them due process. And that has failed here over and over again. And that is, to me, a problem. And continuing to counsel Judge Detsoy doesn't seem to have moved the needle on this in any regard. So then what are we left to do if standards isn't allowed to look at that?
Well,
then we aren't. And that becomes a systemic problem. That's what I'm getting at when you say standards can't look at legal problems or legal error, because that can't be true in the aggregate.
Well, I guess a couple of things. The original position, I think, of judicial standards in looking at these particular cases was based upon its view that in the, I'm blanking on the case now, but there was a case that they cited over and over again for the proposition that unless the defense raised the issue of subject matter jurisdiction, then the court couldn't raise it on its own. And so that's kind of how this started, and that's part of the reason why I'm saying this was an example, this was an abuse by the Judicial Standards Commission of going in and basically making it formal charges, instituting formal charges based upon its view that it was right on the law and Judge Detsoy was wrong on the law. All I can tell you about the practice of not holding hearings is what I've said before. The evidence was he didn't hold hearings because he was concerned about whether he had authority to do so.
So it kind of sounds to me, Mr. Brandt, that the commission was concerned not so much whether he was right or wrong on the law, but how he was going about making those decisions. And that not holding a hearing, to me, it doesn't hold water. If you have a case involving sovereign immunity under the Tort Claims Act, under the one view, I don't know if I have jurisdiction, but I don't think I've got jurisdiction in these kind of cases, so I'm just dismissing it. You don't hold a hearing, you don't have argument, you don't have, nobody appears, and people are telling you that the law is contrary to that, and you say my view is different, and so I'm going to continue doing it the way I'm doing it without a hearing or notice.
Well, I mean, I also think that there's a fundamental problem with this being a Judicial Standards Commission inquiry. I think judges are charged with making decisions. Judge Detsoy was elected by the people of McKinley County to preside in these cases. He was elected to make decisions based upon his best understanding of what occurred in those cases. And I don't think it's for the Judicial Standards Commission to come along after the fact and second-guess his decisions. And that's what happened in every single one of these cases.
Or did they second-guess the way he was making
well,
those
decisions?
Well,
in some of them he did. In some of them, most of them he didn't. In counts 3 through 8 and 10 and 11, those don't have anything to do with whether he held hearings in cases. Those are purely matters of the Judicial Standards Commission going in and saying he made the wrong decision as a matter of law in this case, and that constituted willful misconduct in office. And that's not right. That's not what the function of the Judicial Standards Commission should be. That's not what the Code of Judicial Conduct requires.
Thank you, Mr. Brandt.
Thank you.
Petitioner, you have 12 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Chief Justice. going back to due process, because there were a few things respondent's attorney said that were inaccurate. One of the things that he put in his response was that the commission is involved throughout the proceedings. Well, that's not true. Once the notice of formal proceedings, as soon as the commission, as soon as they approve charges, they are no longer a part of the investigation. All that happens is on regular commission meetings, I let them know where we are, whether or not there's going to be a hearing on the merits. And how long that's going to be, you know, keep your schedule open for 5 days. But there is a certain point, so they do take part in the investigation, and they let me know what to do in the initial investigation. You know, when I present the original charges, they say, well, we'd like to talk to this judge. Let's set it for an ICC. Well, I think there are still charges. Let's approve a notice of formal proceedings. But they take no part in the investigation after that point. So the response saying that they are a part of the procedure throughout the proceedings is not accurate. They don't see anything after the NFP. Another reason or a reason to have to appoint special masters is clearly because of the conflict. The conflict is actually listed in Article 6, Section 32 of the Constitution. There's a conflict that it sets up, and it's down at the bottom, second to the last paragraph. It says judges who are part of the commission can't take part in their own investigation. Well, that's a situation that creates a conflict, and that's an instance where special masters can be appointed. Here, in going through the history of the Judicial Standards Commission, there have been two occasions where special masters have been permitted and actually were chosen. In one of those occasions, don't know how special masters were appointed for one of them. I was able to find out for the other one that special masters were appointed because of the working relationship that the executive director at the time had with the defense attorney of the judge who was going through the proceedings. That was another conflict. But, you know, this suggestion that we should divide ourselves, that is, the commission should divide itself, which is a suggestion that counsel for a respondent just made. The Constitution sets up a very diverse set of voices within it. We should want this diverse set of voices. One municipal court judge, one magistrate court judge, two district court judges, two attorneys, seven citizen representatives appointed by the governor. The attorneys are appointed by the bar. The judges are appointed by the Supreme Court. That's what we want to have. That way, if there's a district court judge that comes in, there are people that are familiar with
that. I understand that, but it doesn't get to the fundamental question that Mr. Brandt brings up, which is when you're wearing both hats, and I don't think there's an argument to be made here that the commission's not truly wearing both hats, that calls into question every decision that's being made. And we hold judges to this extremely high standard, higher than anybody else that's in public office. Shouldn't we afford them stronger due process? Because, I mean, this court has done things such as remove a judge based on an accusation of DUI. No due process afforded to that judge. You can retire or we're taking your retirement away. Where is the due process in that when we're removing somebody from their livelihood? And if we're going to say we're going to hold judges to a really high standard, why shouldn't standards be set up in the same manner? And the diversity and all that, you can do that with having two buckets of people at the commission and having diversity that way. Or you could appoint masters. Take the commission out of that. Why aren't we meeting like with like? And that does ring to me in a way.
Chief Justice and Justice Bacon, in this particular case, in this particular occasion, you had said, where is the due process? The due process is throughout
Well, no, but you've got, there's due process, meaning you get notice. But there's also procedural due process. There are two different types of due process. And what Mr. Brandt is focusing on is the other type of due process, which is that fundamental fairness thread. And so if somebody's both the accuser and the decider, it gets wonky. And that troubles me.
Chief Justice and Justice Bacon, it's completely understandable. It's not lost on me. I understand that there could be an appearance. I would just go back to U.S. Supreme Court precedent saying that there is a presumption of honesty and integrity as those serving as adjudicators. It certainly hasn't been overcome in this case.
Let's talk New Mexico case law. There's a case, I think it's called Reed versus the Board of Optometry, where the board, in a licensing case, a member of the board said he's guilty. He did what he's accused of doing. And sat on the case itself to make a decision, and they ultimately took away the doctor's license. In this case where, and this court held, he may have listened, he may have done this, that, the other, but just the fact that that happened had such a tinge of unfairness and impropriety, it reversed. You know the case I'm talking about?
Chief Justice, Justice V. Hill, I'm unfamiliar with that case, but that would make sense.
Okay,
Judge.
So we turn to the Judicial Standards Commission. They're participating in the investigation. They decide to proceed with the formal case. Isn't that tantamount to saying he did something? And now I'm going to sit on the case where I said he did something, just like in the board in the Reed case.
Chief Justice and Justice V. Hill, I am unfamiliar with the composition of that board and what specifically how it was structured. I do know that per the Constitution, the Commission is to hear cases before it. It can appoint special masters.
We understand that.
So,
and the fact that it didn't is the argument. The argument is because they didn't, I was denied due process.
Justice Vigil, I completely understand the argument. Here, we follow the Constitution. We followed U.S. Supreme Court precedent. We followed New Mexico Supreme Court case law when it comes to the Judicial Standards Commission, and that's why I'm trying to distinguish our case from the case with the optometrist.
They're both administrative proceedings. They're both adjudicative cases. They're both involved taking somebody away from their job. You know, it seems there's a lot of parallels.
Would it mitigate the court's concern in that context of administrative law? The Board of Optometry makes a decision, is a regulator. Supreme Court is a regulator in this circumstance. Do you agree?
Chief Justice, I would agree.
To Justice Vargas's question, the other, I would like you to address sort of if there is any mitigation of the concern that there does not seem to be much of a challenge on the sufficiency. So the check that we are serving as the decision maker and review both law and facts, even with deference, there does not seem to be much of a dispute or argument on sufficiency to these claims. Would that mitigate any concern they have with regard to this process or not?
Chief Justice, I would agree that it should mitigate that, that there is no dispute on the facts in this particular case. In fact, there's no accusation that we weren't fair in this process. There's just the appearance that it's not fair because of the dual.
But if judges are held to an appearance of impropriety, shouldn't the people recommending removal be held to the same standard?
Chief Justice, Justice Bacon, I would just go back to the Constitution. There is a way to make that possible, and that is by constitutional amendment. The only
we determine that the Constitution, this particular provision of the Constitution, is unconstitutional. It doesn't require amendments.
Chief Justice, Justice Bacon, you are absolutely correct. I didn't mean to take away this court's power. This court could certainly do that. I wasn't trying to suggest that.
What makes mistakes of law, error, as Mr. Brandt argues, willful?
Chief Justice, when it's egregious, when there's a pattern of behavior, and this is developed more thoroughly in our petition, when it's egregious, when it's a pattern of behavior, and when it's bad faith. In this particular case, there was a question by Justice Zamora about whether or not there were any hearings in the cases, in the counts before this court. No, there were no hearings in the cases before this court. This is willful misconduct, and it can't be described as anything other than willful judicial misconduct, this set of circumstances. Normally, I would need to prove through the Locatelli case that the conduct by the judge was intentionally and knowingly and in bad faith, not in this particular set of circumstances. I will use the Salazar case. This is a 2013 case, paragraph 18. Repetition of the very conduct that has been characterized by the commission as improper cannot be said to be anything other than judicial misconduct. In this particular case, in February 2024, the commission said, we just want you to have hearings. There was a justice who had a question, is the commission mad about the decisions or mad about not having hearings? Obviously, the commission is concerned about the judge not having hearings. So in February 2024, the commission said, from now on, have hearings. June 10th, 2024.
And that didn't happen.
Justice Bacon, I was going to say that.
Yeah,
okay. State versus Begay, State versus Rowenhouse, on June 10th, 2024, both dismissed the same day the criminal complaint was filed. State versus Space.
One question. The Chief Justice is up. Can I ask
one
question?
Yeah, we have a couple more.
I think I'm reading this right, but I want to make sure. I don't understand how the judge decided which cases where jurisdiction would be raised, because he wasn't doing it in every single case. So that is also a concern I'm having. Like, how do you find judges can bring things up sua sponte, but then it should be applied fairly and evenly? And I'm not getting that from what I read. Can you just explain that to me?
Chief Justice, Justice Zamora, the cases that are before this court and the cases that are in front of the commission are cases that were brought to our attention. So in reality, the judge could have been, the respondent could have been dismissing absolutely every case before him. We just are unaware of that. We got complaints, and they let us know, hey, this case was dismissed the same day the criminal complaint was filed. This other case, it was dismissed the same date the criminal complaint was filed. So that's why you're only looking at 12 cases when you're correct. The testimony was that many more cases were dismissed. Only 12 cases are before this court.
Just speak.
When we are reviewing recommendation of the commission, what is our standard of review?
Clear and convincing evidence?
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Justice Bacon, clear and convincing evidence.
Anything else? All right, thank you, counsel. In the matter of S1SC 40574, inquiry concerning a judge. The court at this time will take this matter under advisement, and we will conference the matter. On some occasions, we're able to come out and announce the decision in court. So I would ask that the parties stay close and be in communication with the clerk's office. If we are not able to reach a conclusion, we will advise the clerk, and we will let you go on your way. But for now, please stick around. We are in recess until further call to court.
And the court stays.